My name is Andrew Calabrese. Today is Wednesday, April 12th, and it's 9:30 a.m., and this is panel 4005. Thursday, but it is the right time and date. The panel is provocatively titled, Can We Feed 20 Billion People in 2050?
Ten.
All right, two mistakes I promise not to make anymore. I'm a professor of media studies and have an increasing interest in media and food politics. I am thrilled to be here with this panel. If you have read their bios, you would know that these are some of the people you want thinking about this question and answering this question for you. Our first speaker is Pamela Ronald. She's a distinguished professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at the Genome Center at the University of California in Davis. She's the founding director of the Institute for Food and Agricultural Literacy at UC Davis, and she directs the director of grass genetics at the Joint Biotechnology Institute in Emeryville. She was instrumental with her collaborators in identifying genes of rice that control the rice response to infection and to tolerance to stress. She's the author of Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. And her list of accolades from prominent publications and organizations and awards is too many to mention right now. But the kinds of words that keep cropping up are most creative, innovative, benefit to humanity, most influential people in biotech. Our next speaker is Meriwether Hardy. She's chief of staff at Biological Capital, an investment firm that is focused on sustainable development. Prior to her current position at Biological, she was working for Rainforest Alliance. She traveled to field projects around the globe to identify challenge areas and designed and implemented solutions. She was a journalism fellow with Bill McKibben, and she's reported on the swiftly changing landscape of Patagonia, specifically the challenges of sustaining indigenous livelihoods that have been presented by the competition between traditional agricultural practices and modern land conservation techniques. At Biological Capital, she's involved in projects and speaking and educating on regenerative agriculture, renewable energy, and climate positive strategies that will help shape the future of the world. We also have David Montgomery, a MacArthur Fellow, which is also called the Genius Grant, and professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington. He's an internationally recognized geologist who studies landscape evolution and the effects of geological processes on ecological systems and human societies. He's authored more than 200 scientific papers and 5 popular science books, including Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, The Hidden Half of Nature with Ann Bickley, and Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. He's been featured in documentary films, network and cable news, and on a wide range of TV and radio. And then we also have Catherine Alford. She's the only one who's not a scientist, per se, but equally important to the question of can we feed 10 billion people. She got her culinary education in France and has been a chef at top restaurants in New York, including the 4-star Quilted Giraffe. She's had many other impressive jobs in the food industry as a manager, educator, cookbook writer. She spent the last 20 years at the Food Network, ultimately becoming senior vice president of culinary, and in that capacity, she developed the in-house brand of Food Network Kitchen. And heard from Catherine on the panel about quinoa. Some of you probably were at it. She has a lot of good things to say about feeding 10 billion people, I think.
No pressure.
So I think we'll go in the order in which you were introduced, and that would mean Pamela will start. And I've asked the panelists to give some comments, talk among themselves in front of you, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming today. It's great to see such an interest in this important subject. So can we feed 10 billion people by 2050? Why not be optimistic and say yes? But as we know, this is going to be a very, very huge challenge. It's going to take the best science, the most appropriate ecologically based farming practices, and political will. So I'd like to just give you a little bit background on one of the projects that I've had the honor to work on, and just to give you an idea of how plant genetics can be an important, will be an important component of addressing this issue. So I work in rice, which is a staple food for more than half the world's people. In some parts of the world, there are tremendous floods and that overrun the rice cropland. And as the climate changes, it's expected that these floods will occur more frequently and will last for a longer time. So rice, most rice varieties grow well in standing water, but most varieties will die if they're submerged for more than 3 days. So this is a huge problem for farmers in South and Southeast Asia who live on less than $2 a day. So the International Rice Research Institute, scientists had been looking for ancient varieties of rice that could survive the flooding. And they were able to find one that had an amazing property. It could survive 2 weeks of flooding, and then when the flooding subsides, regrow again. So breeders decided to try to introduce that trait through conventional breeding. But every variety that was developed was rejected by the farmers, because in conventional breeding, not only do you draw in the gene encoding the trait of interest, you draw in lots of other genes that have negative effects on the rice plant. So we decided, my collaborators and I, decided to try to isolate the gene encoding the trait. We hope that if we could isolate this gene, we could bring it in using modern genetic techniques, either marker-assisted breeding or genetic engineering, and in that way, develop a variety that would be useful for farmers. So we were successful at developing a rice variety for farmers in eastern India and Bangladesh that can survive floods for up to 2 weeks. And it's been a really exciting project. There are many people involved, including the International Rice Research Institute, the Bangladeshi Rice Research Institute, the Indian Cuttack Rice Research Institute, many years of field trials, and a really fantastic team. The rice can survive 2 weeks of flood, and farmers growing that rice see a 3- to 5-fold increase in yield. Last year, 10 million farmers grew sub-1 rice. So just based on this experience, I hope you can see that plant genetics has a really important role to play in feeding 10 billion. And not that it's the only important component, but it will continue to be a very important aspect of feeding the future. Now, and I just want, I see there's some young students here, and this is for the young and the old. During these talks, I want you to think about where you get your scientific information and whether you think that information is scientifically credible. And the reason I'm bringing this to you is because as we move forward, we need to use science-based information to inform our policies, because misinformation in the media, whether it's about politics or food or farming, can really divert us off from the path of feeding 10 billion people. So I was at a high school a couple days ago, and we asked the students, and they kind of scratched their head, well, the cereal box. And that's really an interesting answer, because I think that the cereal box is indeed where a lot of people get their information. But you have to realize the cereal company is trying to sell you that cereal. It's not necessarily anchored in science. And so I hope we'll have a chance to talk about where we all get our scientific information. And I have to confess, as a scientist, I feel we have failed to make it easily accessible what is a major scientific organization, where can you get reliable information? So I hope we'll have a chance to talk about that. Thank you.
Wonderful. So I have a quick question. My name is Meriwether Hardy, and I'm excited to be here with you all. Out of curiosity, how many farmers do we have in the room? Got a couple. Nice. How many people have backyard gardens or grow some of their own food? Very cool. Very cool. So I grew up on a farm in Vermont, and I can speak firsthand to, in order to be successful, and those farmers in this room know that, farmers have to be marketers, communicators, they have to brand themselves, they have to be experts in whatever crop they're growing, they have to be business experts, they have to know how to run their books, they have to think about leadership, and if they have a team, how do they interact or manage the team, and farmers have to wear so many hats and have so many barriers or so many things that they have to be experts in order to get that food on your table. And one thing that I've dedicated my work to is how do we provide support and resources to farmers? I worked on this for many years in the nonprofit sector, and I believe that we have to work on solutions from all different sectors. But the company I now work for, Biological Capital, works on how do we really change the financial model for how we grow our food, how we get our energy, and how we build habitat. And if we can change that financial model, the regenerative options that we show are possible can actually be scalable. When I think about how are we going to feed the world in the future, I have a couple things that I want to hit on. And oftentimes when I'm speaking on a panel with maybe someone who comes at food from a more technology expertise or technology solutions, and I don't know if any of us will get into that more so today, but I like to focus my personal solutions and the solutions we do for work on a couple key things of what we can do right now and already. The first is collaboration. Historically, regenerative, sustainable farmers have really been pitted against larger scale farmers. And you have the conservation world pitted against ranchers or kind of more, you have these kind of people working on solutions and working to try to come up with good ways to grow food and feed the planet, but are really on opposite sides of the spectrums. And it's so important to me that we continue to bring these groups together and we continue to work together versus being on opposite sides. Another thing is that we really need to increase our yields with the land we already have. Historically, we have continued to clear more land when we need to create more food. When you look at feeding the world in 50 years from now, if we continue to use our current practices, we're going to have to increase the amount of food that we're currently growing by 70% to feed the future. And we can't do that with the amount of water we currently have, the amount of topsoil we currently have. So we need to find solutions to grow more with what we already have. And there's a lot of innovative things happening out there. Another thing is that we need to shift our diets. Right now, over 50% of the food that's grown, those calories and that food goes to animals or producing fuel or energy. And so only 50% of the calories that are grown around the world right now are actually being consumed by humans. Of that 50%, about a third of it is wasted. Whether it's wasted in the fields, whether it's spoiled in transport, or whether it goes bad in my refrigerator that I then end up composting, or I go out to a restaurant and I only eat half of my meal, or something in a grocery store starts going stale. So another key area is we need to reduce our current amount of waste. The last area that I'll hit upon is the one that we really focus on with Biological Capital is farmers. When you look at a triangle and you look at the bottom layer of that triangle and look at, it's a food triangle, and the bottom layer is where food is grown. A farmer generally, when they're growing vegetables and they're selling them as raw produce, are only making about 4 to 6% of return on that product or on that raw crop. When you go up that food pyramid and you get to all of the people who are processing or transporting the food, they make about 8 to 10%. You get to the top of the triangle and you look at a restaurant or you look at a grocery store where they're actually selling to the consumer, and that's about a 20% return. So when you look at that whole food pyramid, farmers are growing the food, but they're making the smallest kind of piece of pie. And one of the things we do is try to figure out how can we help farmers, or how do we help the projects that we work on not only grow the food but process the food, cut out middlemen, cut out middlewomen, and sell that food directly to consumers so that the farmer can retain more of that profit. So those are kind of some of the areas that I feel passionate about and that I currently get to spend my days thinking about.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. Well, as you heard in the introduction, I'm a geologist, so you might be wondering, what does a geologist have to say about farming and the future of food? And to answer that question, let's look back at the past and the history of food. Because if we face a challenge of feeding the world in 2050, think about all the land that's been taken out of agricultural production in the last 10,000 years around the world. It's about equivalent to a third of the world's current farmland that we've already degraded to the point that we're no longer growing food on it. It would be a lot easier to feed the world if we hadn't done that. So the obvious question is not, well, who's to blame? Because everybody that's to blame is dead and has been dead for centuries. Well, not totally. We could talk about the 20th century. Maybe we'll get into that a little later. But the right question to ask is, could we turn that around? Could we actually restore land back to fertility? And that happens to be what I wrote my most recent book about, because the answer is yes, we can. Because people have done it all around the world by adopting regenerative farming practices to bring their soil back to life. And some of the benefits from doing that are that we can use fewer agrochemicals. Not necessarily get off of them. That's a different choice. That's a choice of farming systems, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But we can use less diesel, we can use less agrochemicals, we can grow just as much food, if not more food, on land that we restore to fertility if we change the farming system that we work. And by the system, what I mean is the philosophy of how we think about the soil. And that's why a geologist can actually think about these things, because I was trained to think about how do soils form naturally. And if we look at the pace at which soils form naturally, it's really darn slow. You know, it takes centuries for nature to form an inch of topsoil. And if you think about forming soil by breaking up rocks and mixing it with organic matter, biologic material, or things that were once living or are living now, the living and the dead, that's how you make healthy, fertile soil. And we could talk more about the role of soil life in fertility. It's just as important as chemistry and physics. We kind of forgot about that in the 20th century in thinking about agronomic applications. But if we think about the practices that could bring soil back to life, quite literally, they are things that are very much the antithesis of the philosophy that underpinned farming for much of the last 100 years. It's basically about cultivating the beneficial life in the soil, which involves really three key pillars: stop plowing, grow cover crops, and grow more than one or two crops. And we think about the dominant philosophy of agriculture in the 20th century. It was intensive tillage with a lot of chemical use to substitute for fertility or to enhance it, not necessarily substitute for it, and to grow one or two crops, functional monocultures. If you look back through the history of farming, large scale, the big villain in the destruction of soils for ancient civilizations was the plow, frankly. That was the subject of my first book, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, and I encourage you to read that history. It's sobering. It took me 10 years to write the optimistic sequel. In between, what I had to do is go visit farmers who had already restored fertility to the land in Central America, in Africa, in the Dakotas, in Ohio, in Canada. And the common elements that those farmers had who had brought their soil organic matter back to higher levels than in nature in some cases, had made their native soils, and had done it in the course of years to a decade or two, which to a geologist is shockingly fast. The common principles that those farmers had adopted were those ones I just enumerated: ditch the plow, cover up, and grow diversity. Now, some were bringing livestock back into their operations, which is another interesting thing we could talk about in terms of its applications in regenerative farming. But I think it's a very productive line of thinking to look at as we face this question of, can we feed the world of the future? And I think 2050 is not the right date we ought to be thinking about. We ought to be thinking about the next 500 years, not the next couple decades. We need to get through the next couple decades, obviously. But the most recent UN report I've seen on the global state of the soil suggests that we're continuing to degrade the world's agricultural capacity at a pace of about 0.3% a year in terms of our global food production capacity due to degradation of the land, degradation of the soil and its fertility. That's a small number, but if you play it out over a century, it becomes a big number. We need to be rethinking our basic agricultural philosophies, not on the sort of the technology versus 12th century organic farming kind of way it tends to get framed in the media. we need to be thinking about embracing all the tools that we could use at our disposal to build and enhance the fertility of the land so that our descendants' descendants are going to be able to farm as productively as we can today. And the comments about feeding the world in terms of waste and shifting diets, I mean, they're right on. There's lots of flexibility there. I think the simple answer to the question we were asked today is, yeah, yes, we can feed the world in 2050. The question is, will we?
So I'm only slightly intimidated to be on this panel. As the food person and as the consumer, and listening to all these people, I'm sort of like, well, what is, you know, a chef and a food writer and someone who's spent on the consumer end and just cooking food for the last 30 and 40 years? And what my takeaway from this is how important each one of us is in this question for how are we going to feed people now, later, 500 years from now, et cetera. And when I first looked at the question, of course, I kind of gulped. And then I went, well, 30 years, in just the 30 years that I have been in the food system and thinking about it, the transformation and the way we talk about food, where we think about food, has been transformative. And I think the important thing to remember is these are serious questions, and you kind of can go, oh, I can't solve these problems. I can't do anything. It's all very negative, except you, each one of you are an incredibly important person in the food systems that you live in because you make choices. You buy food, and then you cook it. And, you know, what you are telling the person you're buying the food from or the CPG companies or wherever you fit in this, and particularly all these young people that are in here, influences where all the way back up to the farmer and those decisions. So one thing I just sort of wanted to gulp when you said that people are getting their information off of cereal boxes. I have a picture of a new cereal box that just came out, and it's for Lucky Charms, and it has unicorn-shaped and pink rainbows in the candy sugary thing that goes in there. Now, if that's our future, we are a little bit screwed. Okay? And that is an absolute reaction to the love affair on social media of galaxy cakes and unicorn pies and all of these things that are very shareable in social media because they're visual, they're fun, they're playful, they're entertaining. They're not food. All right? And so it's really important to understand, I feel very strongly in the food media space, we do have a responsibility to really get our act together and not just be looking at our metrics by how many things get shared. So really simple choices of how many vegetables are you buying? Like Meatless Mondays that are being done and promoted by chefs and cookbook authors and talking about vegetables, it's really kind of boring. It's sort of like, yeah, my mom told me to eat vegetables. But it isn't just because your mom is telling you to eat vegetables. It's to really be engaged in feeding the world in 10 years, 20 years, and 500 years. It makes a difference. Real food, less processed food, all these answers for consumers are pretty darn simple. Talk to farmers. And you can know where your food comes from. Shorten your food chain. One of the best jobs I ever had in New York was working as a green market manager and watching the green markets in New York transform what went on in the Hudson Valley and make connections in neighborhoods. And it isn't just about, you know, bougie food for chefs. It's about restoring neighborhoods and communities and making food accessible to people that don't, and food deserts. You know, having a green market in Harlem brought vegetables where there are no grocery stores. So these kinds of choices and engagement, you know, the green market movement in New York City started in, there was one market under the bridge in 1976. The neighborhood was hostile toward it. They didn't really want it. Now, in 2018, there are 46 markets. They're all throughout the city. There are other parallel programs to do this, and they've transformed neighborhoods that were kind of not just food deserts, but like terrible neighborhoods to be in. But having markets and that relationship with farmers transforms the city and is considered one of the most wonderful things about New York. A very urban, you don't really think about farmers in New York City, but they have become a part of it. So I just really want to encourage you to really think about everything that you put on your table and how you cook it. And if vegetables seem hard, they're really one of the, and everyone says, gosh, vegetables take so long. I have to like chop them up. I have to do all these sort of things. They're really good cooked whole and just roasted in the oven. You don't have to make it hard. Cooking is really one of the most pleasurable, but also fundamental things. Remember, it is one of the few things that you do every single day. And so having food literacy, to all those youngsters in the back, it should be a life skill that we don't look down on what, we don't food shame people, but we get people engaged as a creative but also integral part of these larger food system questions.
So would you guys like to offer any comments, reflections on what each other has said?
I'd love to just jump right in and add to that comment, because people all the time ask me, what can I do? And here we are kind of focused more talking in the moment about the science. And sometimes to me, even that can feel really overwhelming, or what can you as an individual do? And consumers have so much power, so much power. And I worked for years, as you shared, with Rainforest Alliance, this international certification agency. And they're the green frog with a seal on it that you see on coffee and chocolate and flowers. And there are so many good certifications out there. It's a little confusing, actually. There can be confusion about how many are out there and what they mean. But I think one of the things that you can do as an individual is, whether it's so important to be buying local and know the farmers you're buying from, and the chair that you're sitting on right now, where did that wood come from? The coffee you drank this morning, where did those coffee beans come from? The chocolate bar that you'll eat tonight, where did it come from? All those things can't be grown here locally in Colorado. And choosing to educate yourself on some of those certifications and some of the places that you can buy and support good practices is a really, really powerful way to impact the market. I would work with really big companies, small companies and really big Fortune 500 companies, to try to show them the business case for certification. And one of the things they always said was, well, our consumers don't care. And I saw a huge change in the years that I was working for Rainforest Alliance of companies starting to say, our consumers care, we need to get certified. We need our supply chain certified. So literally, when you go to the gas station, you fill up your car with gas, you go in the gas station, you go buy a granola bar, look to see if there's a certification on there. And if there's not, choose one that does have one.
I think I'll jump in a little bit. And of course, I agree with my esteemed panelists here. But again, I think that we need to consider that a label, a stamp, doesn't necessarily mean anything unless it's anchored to science. Mm-hmm. And so some certifications, I'm sure, are going to be very, very useful, but many are quite misleading. And so where do you go to find out what that certification means? And so I'm going to suggest you go to the United States Department of Agriculture, the National Academy of Sciences, the World Health Organizations, because you walk into a market and it's overwhelming. So you see Whole Foods Market, all these supplements, and you should be aware that it says, okay, this is certified natural. That's a label, but it's meaningless. And in fact, supplements are not regulated. It's the one aspect of our food system that's not regulated and can be quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important not to just buy something that has a label, because it often doesn't mean the non-GMO label, GMO-free. I mean, it has no scientific meaning, and it also, in many cases, means that the farmer is going back to 1950s kinds of chemical applications. And it's not what the consumer believes. So they see the label, they think it means something else. I'm just going to caution a little bit.
There's an extra step, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's totally right.
And it's challenging, obviously. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could help somehow during this discussion.
Yeah.
Shall I start with the questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask one of my own before we move on. And it's about the plow. David, because I think people would be really interested in hearing you say more about why we should get rid of the plow. This is such an important subject centered around farming today. And I wanted to also remind you that there was a documentary film that you probably, I'm sure, are aware of from 1936 called The Plow That Broke the Plains. So it's odd that we've been thinking about the problem of the plow for so long and not solving it.
Well, we've figured out ways to solve it today, but what is the basic problem? What is the basic problem of the plow? And we have figured out ways to solve it today, but the basic problem of the plow is pretty simple. How many of you have ever gone out to a native grassland or forest and seen vast swaths of bare earth below timberline?
Thanks.
Where? I saw a lot of plants around here. I don't see a whole lot of bare earth. I see bedrock. If you get steeper than 45 degrees, you're on a cliff. You're not holding soil on it. That doesn't count. Nature tends to clothe herself in plants. You go around most of the world and check the UN Global Soil Database. There's about 1 to 3 feet of soil on most hillsides in the world, or at least there were originally. You go to Syria today, there's approximately 0 feet of soil on much of the landscape in places where we have Roman tax records that there were large harvests of wheat off the same land. And you can find ruins, buildings, where the foundations now stick up a couple feet above the bare rocky slopes. You don't build foundations above ground. The problem with the plow is that by leaving the ground bare and vulnerable to erosion by wind or rain, between the time you plow and the time the crop or the weeds, if you don't plant anything, comes in, is that erosion can proceed faster than the soil is being rebuilt. And any system where you're losing something faster than you're replacing it means you're running out of it. Iowa's already burned through half their topsoil in 200 years of farming. The eastern Washington, the Palouse, same deal. About 50% of their topsoil has actually been removed from farms and translocated to somewhere else. This is a problem that plays out over generations. It's not a particularly big problem in any one year, but it can add up to a really large problem. You look at the American Southeast, from Virginia down to Georgia in the Piedmont country, the hill country. There were about 6 to 12 inches of rich black earth there when the first journals, the first plantation owners and farmers described the land and how all you had to do is clear the forest and you could get 3 to 5 years of incredible tobacco production out of the land, and then you couldn't anymore. Because you get intense rain there and it was sort of clear cultivated, they lost the topsoil. You go to farms in North Carolina today, and if there's any soil scientists in the room, you'll know what I'm talking about here, and I'll explain it in a minute. But the A horizon is gone. The topsoil is gone. They're farming the B horizon. In other words, the rich black earth, the topsoil, has all been eroded off, and they're farming the subsoil, which is not where the greatest fertility in a soil profile lies. The problem with the plow is that if used over generations, outside of a floodplain, you can literally strip the soil off the landscape. And tillage degrades soil organic matter over time. It accelerates the breakdown. It stimulates the microbes in the soil to break down the organic matter, and you essentially mine it out of the soil. So you get a little burst of fertility. You get exceptionally good weed control. But if you maintain it over the long term, you lose the soil. And that's why a geologist would think that a plow is one of the more destructive implements that mankind has ever invented. Now, so what do we do about it, I think was the other part of your question. And that's a good question. And that's where no-till farming methods that actually do not involve the plow, there's studies that document that can shut erosion down to basically the background levels. And there's a lot of recent experimenting with crop rotations and the style of sequencing of things on a farm to use other means of weed control than the herbicides that became very popular with no-till farming. And in Growing a Revolution, I describe farms around the world that have learned how to manage weeds in no-till systems without herbicides. It's not very common, but it's feasible. And I know that because I've visited people who've already done it. How'd they do it? Some do it by bringing livestock back onto their farms to graze off the cover crops. Others do it by relaxing about their weeds and realizing that it actually is not much of a yield drag in their system to begin with. And you can, if you think of a weed as something that is getting nutrition out of the subsoil, bringing it into the biological world, and then you kill that weed or that cover crop, because a cover crop is a weed you don't like to go to seed. You plant it and you kill it before it can go to seed. And if you kill a weed before it goes to seed, you can think of it as a cover crop. Now, of course, you don't want it to go above your crop and shade it out as it's coming in, so you got to worry. That's why you're better off intentionally planting particular cover crops in a particular point in particular rotations that you need to figure out based on the region and the crops and the soil and the climate that you're farming in. But if you think about cover crops or weeds, if you kill them at the right time, as things that bring nutrition out of the subsoil, get it in the biological world, then you kill it, and it rots, and you let the microbes in the soil break it back down into its elemental constituents that the plants can then take up, you're basically using it as green fertilizer. And many of the farmers I visited who had done this for a number of years found that they could greatly reduce their fertilizer use after they rebuilt their soil organic matter through the use of cover crops in no-till systems with a diversity of crops. And it's important to note that they were more profitable because of that. They were able to maintain their yields while spending less on inputs. And if there's one thing that we need across the food system, it's for farms to be profitable. We need farmers to stay in business to feed the rest of us. And so that's why I'm pretty interested in these sort of new ideas of merging some of the modern technologies that allow us to do no-till with the ancient wisdom of cover crops and crop rotations. And it's the three pieces together that, in my view, define a new system of farming that can work on conventional farms to reduce input use, and they can work on organic farms to make them more sustainable. Because with the comments I had earlier about ancient civilizations, it was organic farming that undermined the Roman Empire. It was not agribusiness. It was not agrochemicals, because they did not exist then. It was the plow, to take it back to your question.
Okay, so I'm trying to group questions, and I'm going to throw out a few, and you guys can choose how to respond. But these are all related to communication and information and education about food. And so someone asked, how can we spread awareness of this huge social issue that many people seem to ignore? Another person asked, is eating meat, poultry, dairy bad for the planet? And if so, how can we communicate that? And then thirdly and last, what is the education process to get the general public to understand and be able to use information labels such as GMO on their food purchasing decisions? So please, take it away.
So I'll take the GMO question. So you probably don't know that the GMO, how many of you think you know what the acronym stands for? How many of you think that there are foods that are genetically modified and foods that we eat that are not altered in some way? Everything is altered in some way. And that's the reason that the FDA doesn't use the term GMO, because everything is modified using some type of scientific method. So it's not a scientific term, so it's not scientifically meaningful. And there's specific example of genetic engineering. So how many of you know that all your cheeses have been developed using genetic engineering? So very few. So 90% of the cheeses in the United States were developed through genetic engineering. And that process involves taking a gene from one organism and putting it in another. And how many of you know that some of our medicines are genetically engineered? So that's good, many of you. So this term GMO is very confusing to people because it often means something different to every person. Some people might realize, okay, my cheese is developed using a modern method of genetic engineering, but they might not realize that the certified organic rice they're buying was developed using an older genetic method of modification using radiation mutagenesis. So there are different types of genetic modification. So, you know, irradiation or chemical mutagenesis or grafting two different species together or triticale, using forced pollination to put two species together. These are all sort of older methods of genetic modification. They're all certified organic. The more modern methods of taking one gene and putting it, for example, a bacterial gene and putting it into a plant, that's considered genetic engineering. So there is so much misinformation about this, and it's really difficult. Under Obama, there was a law passed to develop some sort of biotechnology label. And I think it would be really useful if we can get to a label that has all the information you want, so it would be transparent. So you could buy something, and you could go to your computer, and you could read, okay, this is a BT corn. What is BT? Well, it was an organic a pesticide organic farmers use. It's been put into the corn plant, and now farmers spray 10 times less chemical insecticide. That's real information about a specific food. And I think it would be really helpful if we had that immediate scientific information. So then instead of thinking, oh, GMO, you might understand, okay, that means that less chemical insecticides are sprayed on this crop. But it's different for every crop. So I think there is a movement to have greater transparency and science-based information, so you don't have to get your information from cereal boxes or people trying to sell you things. So it's really important to be sure that you're going to a professional scientific organization, a nonprofit group, and not somebody that is just adding a label to try to misinform you to sell more of their own product.
Can I ask a question? I have a question about this.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm not a scientist, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a passionate food person. So I know the GMO is a very complex conversation. Who owns these seeds when you're developing them? Because that's one of the biggest problems that I have, is that when seeds are patented, it's a different relationship for the farmer in terms of their rights to save seeds and use traditional farming methods. So when you have... Who owns them? I mean, that's always been that's taken me out of the GMO first.
So
there, it's like,
know,
when Monsanto owns it, what does that mean for the farmer?
So that, you know, that's a good question. It's a big concern. So there are three major seed companies now. They've been consolidated over the years. In the developing world, most farmers will buy their seed from those companies. So my husband is an organic farmer sitting over there. He buys his seed from the companies. You know, in California, they farm year-round. There's not time to develop your own seed varieties. There's not time to bulk up your own seed, sort your seed, purify your seed. So they buy from these companies. And Monsanto is one of those companies. Whether you like that company or not, they do make seed available for profit. Farmers buy it. Why do farmers buy it? Because it's higher yielding, or maybe it's resistant to a particular insect. So that's why they go to those companies. Now, in the less developed world, it's very different. So the farmers that I work with are subsistence farmers. These farmers, that's a farmer that produces only enough food for them to feed themselves and their family, generally. And they don't have extra money. They don't buy their seed. So rice in Bangladesh is self-pollinated, means that they grow the seed, they harvest it, and they replant it. And in that situation, there's really no availability of seed for them to buy. If it was available, they couldn't buy it. The companies are not interested in selling seeds to Bangladesh because the companies are interested in profit. So the seed that we've developed, it goes through the national certification programs that are distributed to the farmers at the cost of any other seed, and the farmers sell the seed and pollinate it. So I think your question is really good, because there's this idea that there's something called GMOs, and Monsanto controls them. Well, in fact, everything is genetically altered. The seeds that organic farmers buy are also have different types of patents on them. I think it's an important question to consider. As a publicly funded scientist, I would like to see more public funding for breeding and that kind of research. I think it's very important, because these large companies are not going to work on rice for Bangladeshi farmers or banana for farmers in East Africa. So we need to have a robust public funding for plant breeding. But it's not this kind of black and white situation that there's something called GMO controlled by Monsanto that's exploiting a particular farmer. But I think there are, you know, antitrust issues that all of us probably are interested in, that do we want three major seed companies developing and selling most of the seed? That's an important question, but it's a different question, and it involves all seed, not just modern seed.
Here's a question. Oops. That
You asked three questions, not one.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm gonna try and deal with one that hasn't been addressed yet a bit, and maybe we can go back to that one. But you asked that there's one of those questions was, can we eat meat? And I think that's the wrong question to ask. I think what we should be asking is, how is our meat grown? And we should be asking the same question about our crops. Because, you know, farming practices that degrade the land are not the ones that we are should be using to feed the future. And you can look, if you look at with a biogeographic focus around the world, there are environments around the world for one of the best uses of the land is grazing. Native grasslands that don't have a whole lot of water. You can grow more food for people by having livestock eat plants we can't eat. And then we can eat them or the things that they make. What's really the focus in terms of whether we should be eating meat, where I think the conversation should be, is one, there's the ethical question, it's a personal issue of whether you wish to be a vegetarian. That, to me, is an individual moral and ethical question that I'm not going to weigh in for anybody about. The question in terms of, is it environmentally sustainable to eat meat, depends on where we grow it and how we grow it. And
how much you eat.
Well, and how much you eat of it, yeah. And there's health issues there as well, which we could get into. If we really want to dive down deep into the microbiome in your gut, there's good reasons not to eat a whole lot of meat. But there aren't any real good evolutionary biological reasons not to eat meat as a human being. We evolved to do that. Those are personal issues. In terms of the environmental issues, though, there's a huge footprint environmentally from eating meat that's fed corn and grown in confined animal feeding operations. That has a huge environmental footprint. And if we're feeding crops that grown on land that could be used to feed people directly, and instead we're feeding crops from that land to livestock and then eating them, that's not energetically efficient at a planetary scale. But there's ways to grow livestock that don't do that. There's ways to do it synergistically that actually increase our ability to produce food off the land, and that's a bit of the regenerative agriculture. And I'm a bit of a convert to this way of thinking, because a few years back, I would have told you that cows cause erosion and they're bad for the land, because I'd seen examples of bad grazing in California that have done that, studied it, documented that the big gullies north of Marin County in California were due to 19th century dairy grazing, you know, case rock solid, cemented in my mind that cows are bad, they caused erosion. Then I went to visit farmers who would actually use them as a tool of soil regeneration and rebuilding, and I realized the problem's not the cows. The problem was that the way that people were grazing their cows, and that there are systems of grazing that can be used to help regenerate the fertility of the land, and there's styles of cropping and animal husbandry that can be synergistic in terms of boosting food production and getting a little more of both, because the livestock can manure the land. I met farmers who were having their livestock eat off their crop stubble and their cover crops and thereby accelerating the nutrient turnover and cycling on their land. So I think that the question isn't so much should we eat meat, unless you want to engage in the personal, moral, and ethical question, in which case, yes, engage in that, decide however you wish. But in terms of the environmental issues, it's back to knowing how your food is grown, knowing the style. And that's where, with some of the comments on labeling, there are real problems with understanding exactly what's behind some labels. Some, I think, are actually really well vetted and solid. And others, like the all-natural label, it really is meaningless. It doesn't really mean anything. So that's a long answer to that question. But I didn't want to let that one slip by, because I think it's important. And if we go into the human health issues and the microbiome tie-in as well, I mean, that's a bit of a deeper dive. We talk all about that in the hidden half of nature. So when Ann and I changed our diets after researching the human microbiome and its connection to the soil microbiome, we didn't stop eating meat. But we do eat less of it. We also eat less bread and we eat less cheese. But we still eat everything we used to eat, but we eat a lot more vegetables. And there are wonderful ways to prepare them that really aren't that much work.
Okay, so here are two questions, and we've been getting questions, excellent questions from students in the back. We have a lot of middle schoolers here today. Here are some questions about gardening and urban farming. What are your thoughts on urban farming? Think Detroit. And then secondly, what are good crops a family can grow in a domestic garden that produce a fair amount to replace purchasing crops with inefficient growing methods?
Good questions.
That's for you. excuse me. I'll talk first a little bit just about urban agriculture, because it's more and more something that's in our vocabulary and people are talking about, and there are really huge ecosystem benefits to urban agriculture, and I'm spacing out on the name right now, but there's a really good study that recently came out, and I can find it if anyone wants to come up to me afterward and ask, but that was measuring and looking at how the amount of urban agriculture that currently exists in our country, how it helps with different temperature controls in cities and local food systems and education and a lot of different other environmental benefits that urban agriculture allows, such as even catching with stormwater and lots of runoff, where if you have concrete, the water doesn't have anywhere to go, and if you have green space or food, how it catches that water and uses it and helps with all sorts of different issues. So urban agriculture is something that we are looking more and more at, not as the solution to how to feed the world in the future, but as a really important part of both education and having access to local foods. There's a lot of really interesting things happening even here in Denver with urban greenhouses and rooftop greenhouses and looking at how to grow different greens and other things right there in your backyard. So to me, I guess maybe the starting point is that I don't think it's going to be the solution to how we feed our planet in the future, but I think it's going to be a really important tool. And it's also, we have over 50% of our population lives in urban areas, so we are more and more disconnected from remote areas where food is grown. And I think more and more often people I talk to don't actually know how food is grown. So I think urban agriculture, the more focus we can put on it, can be a really important education tool of bringing people back in school systems, in volunteer programs, of growing some of their own food or understanding where it comes from. So to me, it's almost equally an important education tool.
Any other comments on gardening?
Sure. My wife has a beautiful garden, and she grows a lot of food in it. And mostly what we're growing now are salad greens. And we're doing that mostly because we live in Seattle, and there's like 5 farmers markets we can get to any day of the week. And there's wonderful farmers that we can get our meat, dairy, and vegetables from. So we're letting the professionals grow that for us. But we grow most of our salad greens year-round. And the real potential, I think, for urban farming is on the vegetable end of things. I don't think you're going to get grain, meat, and dairy production into the city in an environmentally sustainable manner any time in the near future. But we could do a lot of vegetable production. There's a good examples, 19th century Paris, 20th century Havana, places where almost all the vegetables consumed by an urban populace were grown in the city. If we take the idea of restoring fertility to the land, to soil, and we take it into the city, to the vacant lots in Detroit, to rooftops, to all those parking spots that may get ripped up once automated cars replace our personal vehicles. You know, there will be potential. If we think about restoring the fertility of the land we've paved over and used for other things, we've got to be careful about that because there can be things in that soil we don't want to eat. But we can be careful about that. We can do it thoughtfully. And so I think there's a real future for urban agriculture. And a very important thing is connecting people so that they know where their food came from and they start to think about how it was grown. Because that's the big problem I think we had in the 20th century in terms of human nutrition is we focused solely on yields in terms of thinking about nutrition. And we forgot about what our crop breeding in the 20th century did to the nutritional content of foods, the micronutrient concentration. We forgot about we didn't know about and are only learning about what we did to the soil, did to the ability of plants to produce the phytochemicals and to absorb the micronutrients from the soil that we actually evolved to need.
Okay, we've had several people asking questions about what action can we take beyond gardening, like how to get involved politically, in other words. One person, Emily, just had individual questions for each of you, but I don't want to read them all because it's a dense card. But her question is basically, what can we do in different forums, and compliments to all of you as well, in terms of federal agencies, policy, what kinds of action can citizens take to improve the food system? What kinds should they take?
Oh, I'll answer this as the consumer in the sea of all this information. I live in New York State, and you find out what's happening in your local states on statewide in terms of the policy, your state senators, what they're doing in terms of voting, and how the, I mean, for example, right now in the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, in his preparation for probably running for president, is actually doing good things for agriculture in New York State. Making sure that ag dollars are cycling back into New York State, crops are being used in schools, it's a cycle of money, you know, so if it's grown in New York State, there's a benefit to those farmers to sell it to schools and other New York prisons, et cetera, where they buy money, where they buy food. So it's having an agricultural policies that are statewide and actually knowing what they are and how your legislature is doing that. It takes time. It's hard work. But you need to know about that because those decisions get made. Today, I just read this morning, the Farm Bill is coming up. It's dense. You know, even I heard one of the senators on the from Maine who was working on the Farm Bill and someone also from Washington State. And they were basically like, it's huge. I haven't read all of it. I don't really know what's going to happen. And I'm like, what? You know, this is your job. I was like, that makes me a little nervous.
That was fundraising.
Yeah, I was like, what? Yes, it takes work to know what's out there, but ask questions, be curious. And it's okay not to know all the answers, but to engage in those conversations. And hold, November's coming up, and vote. And know what issues you're voting on. And food is an important issue. It touches health and nutrition and land and all the things that we're talking about. And so it's really important, I think, just to be as informed as you can and make food a priority in your voting.
And just to add to that, remember to vote.
Yes.
Okay, here's a one that could be laughed at but shouldn't be, because I think it hits us here in a way that we don't want to think about it because we're not used to it culturally. Will we be eating more bugs in 2050?
Can I answer that question? Because yes. I feel very strongly about
yes.
this. People in the world have been eating, or already eating bugs. This is, I feel like, yes, we're looking for ultimate, different forms of protein, et cetera. I spend a lot of time in Mexico. They've been eating bugs forever. Part of this is, yes, we're looking for other things, but it's a media sort of story where people can say, I'm going to eat bugs, and it has a shock value to it. Yeah. You're going to pick up that story when it's about bugs. I don't think it's a solution. It's a very, I'm not a scientist, but the media story around bugs really annoys me.
I just hope it's with
peanuts. And they're fine. They taste fine. I've eaten bugs. They're delicious. Damn. It's not a big deal.
Sorry. Any other comments on bugs?
On no, I was just going to say
I've
absolutely
eaten bugs
yes.
too. I've had some good
they
bugs.
They have short lifespans, so in order to raise them, it's a really short. You're putting less resources in, and they oftentimes are very high in protein. So there's some really cool products out there or that are ground up and made of bug flour, essentially, if you really simplify it. And so absolutely yes.
Yeah, and we eat bugs every day. Well, at least in my house we do. Maybe your house is a little cleaner. But I think, all these things are kind of fun and useful, but probably not going to feed the world, right? Because even though you can raise some insects, it takes a lot of energy to raise insects inside in controlled facilities. and you don't want people going out and collecting grasshoppers. You don't want to destroy the native ecosystems. I mean, maybe there's a locust outbreak, you want to be sure to eat those. It's funny, so as a geneticist too, so there's all these political issues about BT eggplant. So this is a single gene from a single bacterium that's used as an organic control that's put into eggplant. So the farmers now don't have to spray any chemical insecticides. And there's a big uproar. So in Bangladesh, farmers have gone from spraying chemical insecticides two or three times a day to zero. But in India, they're like, no, we can't have that here. Because what if that gene from that bacteria is harmful, which it's not. And it's so interesting that there, again, the sort of kind of media frenzy when you feel like, well, we all need to eat bugs, but we don't want to eat BT eggplant. Let's keep spraying those chemicals that we know kill people. So it's really important to balance the risks and benefits and be an advocate for science if you believe that the climate is changing because you support science and accept scientific consensus. Be sure you do that when it comes to food issues as well.
Yeah, and in that, be sure you don't overlook ecological principles for managing insect pests and pathogens, because there are often alternative, scientifically grounded means for achieving the same result. And that's where the policy discussions actually ought to be.
Yeah, that's true. You need to have a diverse, and perhaps, you know, there's a diversified cropping system that can be used to minimize insect populations. You can use crop control, but you also cannot generalize. So you need to look at that farmer in Bangladesh that's growing the eggplant, talk to them what they've been using, talk to them about what they've been trying, and not generalize based on some ecosystem of sugar beets in Colorado, right? Every farm is different.
Yep. Well, every system is different. But there's just a great paper that came out looking at farm systems across the Midwest, so it's not about Bangladesh. But guess which kind of farms people found the most insect pests on? The ones that used the most insecticide. Very solid study. And why is that? Because the insecticides are taken out all the predators that eat the pests. And in the farms that actually had diverse rotations with large beneficial insect populations, there was minimal pest damage. The yield difference was not there, but the pesticide difference is there. So
yeah, I think we need to look at broad-spectrum insecticides considered problematic these reasons.
That's why essentially things like the BT gene can be good by reducing the use of broad-spectrum pesticides. But there may be other alternatives as well that shouldn't be overlooked in the sort of the quiver of science going forward.
Yeah, usually you need a combination. There's no silver bullet when it comes to farming.
Okay, I would like to ask a couple of farmland questions. One person has asked, why is it important to keep our farmland in use? I live by a few farms, and lots of the farmers are selling their land to developers who then build houses, which makes people move here, and we can't feed them. What's your response about farmland use? Dave, you said that we've already got a lot of farmland that is no longer in use that once was.
Yeah, is it fair to quote yourself? Because if so, I think in the dirt book, I said that every acre of farmland that's paved over is an acre that won't feed somebody in the future. It's that simple.
We are working on an interesting project in Vermont, and it's an old, failed dairy farm. And this is happening all over the Northeast, of just the price of milk and kind of a number of different reasons of looking at kind of the older style or more style of keeping cows in a barn, looking at, you've been talking a lot about really extractive models where you keep them in a barn 24 hours a day, you keep the lights on, and you basically stimulate all through all these different ways them to produce milk constantly. And looking at, there's a lot of different environmental, a lot of different health impacts from that. And so this dairy farm was owned by a third generation farmer, and farms all around him had been sold and been developed. and he wanted to keep it as farmland. So he found someone who was willing to buy the farm and work with us to come up with what is the future for how we develop a financial model that allows for farmland to be kept working. Something that's interesting to me is that I think culturally we have oftentimes, I started to talk about this in the beginning, had conservation be pitted against agriculture and food production. Our concept of taking care of land has often been to rope it off and protect it, but there are examples of working landscapes all over the world where you can put more in than you take out and keep that land as productive, but also have it protected. And so what we're really looking at is what's the financial model that allows you to do a diversified agriculture operation with livestock and vegetables and allows that land to be financially profitable. And I believe that it's really important to have those models. We can't ask farmers to continue to fund the land and to be raising funds and putting it in the land and not getting it back. So I'm not saying for that land to be, community projects, but hopefully that they are viable businesses, because I think if they're viable businesses, that land will be kept open. Housing is really important. We are at a housing crisis here in Denver. There's a big need for affordable and workforce housing. But you can do that thoughtfully, and you can do that in dense areas and build up, and then try to keep that agriculture area open and working, because we need the current land we have we need to take care of it better. We need to put more in than we take out. We need to restore it, but we need that land for our future food supply.
Maybe I'll just quickly add, you really need government policy. Mm-hmm. So in California, we lose hundreds of thousands of acres every year. And if you ask a farmer that's older, they're retired, it's their retirement, right? And the land in California is highly valuable. So if you leave it to just capitalist forces, and we're going to lose a lot of the land because people will just buy food, bring it in from elsewhere. So there are models where local governments have said, no, we are not going to develop this area. And between Davis, California, where we live, and another city nearby, they have a massive green belt where the two cities agreed we're not going to develop houses there. And it really is going to take that, because if you leave it to the farmer, of course, they need to have some economic means. If they can farm and earn X amount a year, but if they sell it for development, they're going to have 100X. That's not a decision that is easily made there.
Okay, we have 1 minute left, and I want to apologize to all the people who wrote great questions that didn't get asked. We just, as you saw, we've been getting great answers, and we just can't provide answers to all of them. But I wanted to end with one that hasn't been talked about at all, which is the distribution factor in hunger. And so someone said, could you please address the distribution factor? Someone else put, I think, the distribution factor in a slightly different way, that Catherine, you mentioned food deserts in the U.S. Is humanitarian aid to poorer places something we should try to do? Could also relate, I think, quite directly to the distribution factor. But hunger and distribution is the key here.
I think it's important to consider local food security. So in the places that I've visited and work in Bangladesh and India, it's a really different system. It's not like anybody's going to fly in with a helicopter and drop food. And there are few growers here that have that kind of time and money to give that food away. So what growers need in subsistence farming system is to be empowered in local food security. And that involves a lot of things, like education about different types of integrated pest management, irrigation, perhaps use water more efficiently, but they also need access to seed varieties that will help them grow more food on the same amount of land so they can grow food more efficiently. So this idea of distribution, I think it's really not going to happen that we can take impoverished areas and think that we'll just fly in the food. You really need to empower the farmers to grow the food efficiently and in an ecologically based manner.
I think we're going to have to leave it at that and thank the panelists for a wonderful
talk.
Thank
you.